When Rio Bravo was hired to work on the Charlie Rose show, the open secret of Rose's abusive behavior didn't deter her from a position she felt could launch her career in broadcast journalism. She believed she could navigate any unprofessional behavior that might arise. But she soon learned a devastating truth. No one can accurately predict how they will respond in an abusive situation until they are in one. In her new book, Complicit, How Our Culture Enables Misbehaving Men, Bravo creates a nuanced and multifaceted picture of the cultural and psychological forces that empower abusers and toxic work environments. It's a researched and very personal examination of how we unintentionally condone sexual misconduct and other workplace treatment and what we can do to affect positive change. Again, the name of the new book is Complicit, How Our Culture Enables Misbehaving Men. And it's a pleasure to welcome Rhea Bravo to the roundtable. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's really nice to have you on the program. I found the book fascinating, and I look forward to discussing it with you. Walking in, what did you know of the situation that you would indeed be walking into?
Yeah, you know, as I've explained to people before, you know, we each perceive of ourselves as the protagonist of our own story. And oftentimes when you have a professional ambition, an objective, you know, regardless of what people say that might not align with that dream that you want to make a reality, you can edit things as necessary. And so prior to starting at Charlie Rose, I had heard that he was a difficult boss. I had heard that he was somebody that was fond of younger women. He was somebody who, you know, had never been able to, you know, for example, one of the positions he was considering me for, or at least said he was considering me for, was to be a travel producer, which was a position he had frequently dangled over young women. When I had been told by a longtime producer there that, you know, nobody has ever met the qualifications for that job, my assumption was like, I just got to work harder, right? No, like, I just need to be able to cut it. Never did I think this is a mechanism for a man with power to use work as a pretense for isolating multiple women alone with him in his home or on long-haul work trips, right? So I thought I could cut it. You know, as I explore in the book, our culture is one that prizes toughness and prizes, you know, being an overworked worker. Work is central to our identity, and I wasn't fazed by it. I wasn't fazed by anything I had heard going in.
As you go in, and I'm struck by this, maybe this is misplaced, but you're also, because we're here at NPR and the NPR environment, you're at the PBS environment, and it's not like Charlie Rose was an outlier. This was sort of the way, you know, it's often the way it is in many, many work environments. And yet, don't you think that's somewhat held to a different standard? You wouldn't see maybe this particular type of behavior. This wouldn't be put up with at those institutions.
Well, I think that was the assumption, certainly. And I don't think there's any way to go around. And as we know, multiple men associated with NPR fell during Me Too.
Multiple
men everywhere. And we like to think in terms of sliding scales of bad behavior, and who's to say that the men at NPR compared to the men at NBC, compared to the men, you know, whatever, what have you, right? But I do think there was a certain, when it came to the reckoning with men who had worked in public broadcasting, I do think that for some of us, there was a certain sadness or bitterness that came with it. These are places where people are exceptionally devoted to the mission and to the work and to the storytelling, right? And that devotion is also part of how men get away with some of the misbehavior they get away with.
For you, talk a little bit about the culture you walked into, the conditions that allowed the abuse that you learned about as quickly as you did.
Well, one thing that I think was interesting about the environment that I walked into was it was an open office floor plan. And I bring that up because multiple people told me something to the effect of, you know, it's hard to explain to people why you wouldn't say anything when so much of what happened was viewed by everybody, right? when somebody is being, because I mean, beyond sexual misconduct and harassment, you know, there was also just, it was a very toxic workplace, and there was a lot of mistreatment. And when you see your boss just lose it and yell at somebody for something that feels disproportionate, right? I am not going to pretend that a good boss doesn't get angry or doesn't yell, but this was something else, right? When things like that happen and it is in view of everyone and nobody says anything, the effect is you don't understand any reason why you would speak out, right? That's one of the forces that I explore in the book. Psychologists refer to it as diffusion of responsibility. Also, the environment that I was walking into was just like so many environments that were touched by Me Too. It was highly, highly competitive, right? People had fought so hard to get a job there and had done so much. And they had either put in their time by being an intern for numerous years before being hired, or had used, you know, whatever connections they had. And for the most part, staff there tended to be young. Many people who I talked to describe, like, look, you know, this was my first professional environment, my first experience with unbridled power, and it just set a blueprint, right? I just thought this is how powerful men and powerful institutions work. And for those people who worked there who weren't young, an interesting dynamic was that they had just been there for an exceptionally, exceptionally long time. You know, they were lifers. And whether or not that means they just didn't know any different, or they agreed with it, or whether it was like, you know, who knows the reasons that they stayed. They were part of also what helped to normalize things, right? When you see these established figures and they have been working for him for, you know, 20 some years.
Right. So let's examine that for a moment. What are these cultural conditions that allow us to remain silent in the face of such abuse?
Gosh, how much time do you have?
Let's see. As much as you need.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I've already mentioned is just our glorification of toughness, and in our culture in particular, right? Like, nobody in the Western canon gets celebrated for throwing their hands up and opting out and being like, no, I don't need this, right? It's just, it's not how we do things. And I argue in my book that it's really especially not how we do things in America, right? And I try to examine some of the ways in which neoliberalism specifically, and all of the ways in which we're especially vulnerable in the United States, has made us not just less likely to speak up when we see professional abuse or misconduct, sexual misconduct, also less likely to even perhaps recognize it when it does happen, or in the most insidious cases, to wear it as a badge of honor when it does happen. Right? I mean, studies show the extent to which Americans celebrate and wear it as a badge of honor when they are overworked, right? Which is not how it is in any other country, and certainly not where I live now, which is in Western Europe, right? And when you've already ceded just a level of your own well-being and exploitation to your job, right? You've just already lowered the bar. You've already lowered the bar for what you're going to accept in your workplace. That's one facet of it, for sure. I also explore in the book our need for social connection and our need to always be a welcomed member of a group. And, you know, I talk to people, and however awful their bosses were, however toxic the workplaces were, the connections that they made in those environments were often very strong, right? And I would say there are two parts of this. One is that we do what it takes to belong, and in ways that in the moment we might not be able to recognize the ways in which we're like morally compromising of ourselves or not behaving as we would expect, right? Because we want to meet expectations. A good worker and a good member of a group is somebody who adheres to expectations. There's that component. But then there's also this other component that I found really interesting, and it definitely played out in my conversations with people, and research speaks to this, which is that the struggle and the pain, be it emotional pain, physical pain, it's like a strong bond, right? Like, the bonds that I made with some of the people who worked at Charlie Rose were incredible, right? I still think so highly of them. And when you're in a group context like that, as I explain in the book, it's just like questioning the, you know, you're more likely to do what you need to do for the benefit of the group, right? You're not going right. to stand up and question the leader because you're all in this together.
It's a brotherhood and sisterhood of battle.
For sure. For sure. I mean, the war metaphors were out of control
sure.
every time I talked to somebody. Yeah.
Rhea Bravo is our guest. The name of the new book is Complicit: How Our Culture Enables Misbehaving Men. I assume in many of these cases, this is not to say that there aren't misbehaving men who are unsuccessful, but the fact that this show was successful, the fact that Charlie Rose was an icon in broadcast mm-hmm. journalism, and again, back to PBS, was often considered the gold standard, that could not have helped things.
Certainly not. And there are many stories from women. I mean, lots of the... And I think this speaks to what you're suggesting. You know, some of Andrew Cuomo's victims and women who had spoken out commented on how his behavior became all the more egregious as his star rose, right? During the COVID pandemic, when we all sought a sense of solace through his, you know, his press briefings and when he was getting attention and he was kind of like the antidote to Trump in a time of uncertainty. His behavior, some people have explained that he became all the more audacious and difficult to work for. And there is something to be said, I believe, and research definitely speaks to this. There is something to be said for power creating, lending itself to abuse, and power corrupts, right? As the adage goes. And my book, I didn't want to have to go there because I know that it's often overused and misused, but I realized I absolutely had to explore it. There was no way discussing our complicity in these types of workplaces without delving into narcissism, right? Not just individual narcissistic personalities, but kind of cultural narcissism, because it's so evident time and time again, speaking with people who had worked for physically and emotionally abusive bosses, the traits that they described always aligned with a lack of empathy and an outstripped size of self-aggrandizement, right? I mean, these were, I'm not trying to make a medical, trying to make an armchair diagnosis, but these were narcissistic right. personalities, right? So certainly. And I think our culture, be it celebrity driven, be it profit driven, what have you, it really lends itself to the ascension of these men. I take great care to say it's not just men's narcissist predilection for doing these things. It's also our own predilection for narcissists. I mean, we fall for them. We fall for their attributes and we take it as a sign of, you know, their confidence, as a sign of male leadership and greatness time and again. Whoever the, you know, we all see it. There's always a narcissist du jour that we like to think we can make fun of on Twitter or on other social media platforms. But time and again, the recipe remains pretty uncontested.
When you first described your experience with Charlie Rose, you did so in the New York Review of Books. And there was mm-hmm. a line in that where you write, "The more I struggled to manage the situation, the deeper I sank." And the two words I really want to focus on is the managing of what you mm-hmm. were doing in your mind to manage it. And then that feeling of sinking, that the harder you're working, the harder you're treading water, the more mm-hmm. you're going down.
Mm-hmm. Almost like quicksand is right. I think, you know, how I would describe it. Yeah. I would attribute that sensation. I take very seriously in the book the notion of cultural narratives and the way in which we all use stories to kind of derive a sense of self and an understanding of our behavior and why we respond the way we do in certain situations. And, you know, when there is a lack of understanding about women's real lived experiences in abusive behaviors, we have this binary that we have to resort to. It's like, are we a tragic victim or are we up for it, right? Because when things first transpired with Charlie, I didn't respond in any of the ways that aligned with the stories I had heard about sexual misconduct. I did not slap him. I did not run away, right? It's just awkwardness ensued, and I showed up to work the next day, and I let awkwardness ensue again. But all the while, I was relying on the coping mechanism of finding whatever I could find to give myself a sense of control, right? And telling myself the story of everything that was transpiring in a way in which I could maintain a sense of control. And that's often, you know, we get creative in whatever way can provide us, you know, an immediate sense of well-being, and in a way that can let us, you know, take that sense of well-being with us in the aftermath. And I just worked and worked to try to remedy the situation, but there was nothing I could do in the moment because I just couldn't recognize or comprehend the nature of what was happening. And that sounds crazy, but, you know, as one woman explained to me, who was very open and honest about, you know, just a really horrible boss that she worked for, was that she was like, I didn't have a container for it. Like, we oversimplified these notions of how women are going to respond in the moment or how we will respond in the moment. And then when it doesn't happen that way, we're just, she said, you know, I was left spinning like Dorothy in the Wizard of Oz. I thought that was a good metaphor.
I think in the book you do a really good job of explaining a toxic work culture, because even though there are people there who are going through what you're going through, they're still trying to survive. And if that involves throwing you under the bus, then so be it, because they're going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that obviously makes it a much more difficult situation. I guess my question, the addendum to that statement is a question, which is, what can be done then to have like a groupthink on that, as opposed to people, again, working against each other because the other people are working for the boss?
Well, I think, you know, operations that are cult of personalities are not good ones, right? I think those are workplaces where people need to be especially, especially careful. I'm not going to say that, I know we can't expect people to be any less ambitious, you know, or want to do whatever it takes to get ahead. But I do think we can all just become incredibly more mindful about how power dynamics and many, many factors play out in the workplace. I certainly think that's part of it. In the book, I explored some of the ways that we were kind of able to not have to concern ourselves with the young women who came to work for Charlie, who were interns traveling with him, or who had just been brought on as staff who, you know, didn't have a proper job title, but he had just met them and, you know, told them to show up, these young women. Despite myself having experienced behavior from him that I did not want, you know, I feel like we, and I've talked to other old colleagues who felt the same, it's just, you kind of view them as either they can handle it, or I think it sounds just so bad. Either, you know, this is a independent woman and she can either handle it or she's up for it, right? And it's just this way to let ourselves off the hook, to like not have to concern ourselves with their well-being. I do think there's so much to be said about just a greater awareness on all of these issues. I mean, clearly a lot has been accomplished since the advent of Me Too, bringing about that awareness. A lot of what I explore in the book are kind of psychological tendencies that, you know, we need to be mindful of, make sure we don't bring them into the workplace.
Change has not been seismic, even though the people that were brought down were certainly very large names, and it brought it to our attention. And, you know, how did our workplace change? The workplace changed because there were sexual harassment trainings. But do they work? I mean, you write about this. I mean, not really, right?
No, I mean, there's a lot of very compelling evidence that they do not work. And in fact, some who have studied this extensively would say that they only make things worse, because as I believe some researchers have said that, look, you start any training by identifying somebody as part of the problem, which is what many men feel like trainings do, they're less likely to be part of the solution. And many times they're all the more likely to second guess a woman's complaint. So, yeah, I mean, I think so much of it comes down to, you know, there's who we perceive ourselves to be and the reality of our behavior. so many of these approaches. I mean, and it's not to say that they don't move the dial at all. I believe that they do, but they're just, you know, nothing is a silver bullet. And things, you know, there's lots of stuff out there to indicate that post Me Too, as of now, sexism has remained stable, if not worsened. And that while the most egregious forms of sexual harassment, like quid pro quos, have gone down, you know, much more pervasive and what's grown are forms of gender harassment that kind of plant, not only are they more difficult to combat, you know, things like leaving somebody off of an email that they should be on, or just, you know, really like kind of offhand demeaning comments, things that are not just more difficult to combat because they don't fit the definition of illegal behavior, but that actually like lay a fertile ground for more egregious behavior. So where am I going with that? Yeah, it's not easy, right? I think so much of it comes from just an incredible mindfulness, but also the recognition, as one psychologist who has studied workplace harassment explained to me, just the recognition that if we could stop focusing or thinking in terms of bad apples and instead think in terms of like the situational complexities that give rise to bad behavior, right, that our workplaces would be better off.
When you wrote about your situation, what did you want the result to be? For you, what were you looking for?
Well, you know, when I first wrote the piece that appeared in the New York Review of Books and that led to the book, I just felt a compulsion to write about it. And I felt a compulsion to write about it because I needed to make better sense of it. Because I just felt that despite all of the facts that were true and the reporting that was ironclad, and that the behavior that had been exposed had resulted in, you know, accountability for Charlie, despite all of that, I just felt that there had been just so much was missing. So much of the madness to the situation, and a certain perversity and this inexplicable force at play in the office, that I didn't feel like any of the reporting that I was reading, and it's just also not the nature of reporting to go there, but it's, that wasn't being captured. And that's why I originally wrote the piece, just like, you know, Joan Didion famously said that she wrote to find out what she was entirely to find out what she was thinking. And I just kind of had this compulsion to write to find out maybe what I had been thinking. And, you know, over time it was cathartic, right? It was cathartic insofar that the more I explored, the more I researched, the more I gave it thought, the more I also realized that any notion of shame, right, or beating myself up about how I managed what transpired was just laughable, right? I mean, it is an entire culture, an entire patriarchal culture and a lifetime of psychological conditioning that I was up against. So yeah, if I didn't respond in the way that I would have hoped in situations when Charlie had behaved inappropriately, I can certainly now more easily give myself a break.
When he was fired, how did you react to that? How do you react to that now?
I wrote a piece for Airmail that takes issue with some of the portrayals of women who spoke out during Me Too, because I do believe that we are often portrayed as just driven by this righteous anger and hatred for the men who wronged us. And I have to say that in my own experience and with so many of the women I talk to, that is simply not the case. You know, I may not love Charlie, but I wanted first and foremost accountability. I wanted first and foremost just for the record to be straight. And like so many women, I knew I was going to have to go on the record when I had heard from people that the executive editor and others were calling people to make sure they did not talk to journalists, yeah. Right? And that was frequently the case. Like once you tell a woman that they cannot share their story, or once a woman hears her abuser make a categorical denial, they are just, that's it. Like they're going to go on the record. I mean, it's a pattern in so many of the stories of men who were held accountable during Me Too. So that said, I did not find joy in Charlie losing his job. I took no satisfaction. I mean, I found peace in knowing that some young intern wasn't about to start or some young woman wasn't about to be hired and taken advantage of. And that brought me a certain level of satisfaction, I guess you could say. But, you know, one of the women, the very first woman who went on the record against Rose, Kyle Godfrey Ryan, I mean, the night that the story first came out in the Washington Post, the first expose, I mean, she sat with her kids and they said a prayer together and they made what her children call love bubbles. And like her son, I think her son put lavender into his bubble for soothing and her daughter gave it something else. And they were like, they were just worried about him. They were worried about him because he was so old and they knew he didn't have family and they knew, you know, that the odds of him getting a second chance were low, right? And it's just, all of this is to say that I think for a lot of people, it's, I don't want to say that the emotions are complex, but that there are multiple, multiple layers. And I take no satisfaction in Charlie's suffering, but I am happy to know that it's not happening anymore.
One of the things that really bothers me is that we continually, and not just with Charlie Rose, this is many, many men who have been accused of, as you put it in the title, behaving badly, that there seems to be, oh, well, when are they able to come back and do the, mm-hmm. you know, have they paid the price? Have they done enough time? And,
yeah.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I mean, just to me, that just seems like it's completely missing the point, number one. And number two, if you had someone who, God forbid, was like abusing a child, you wouldn't then hire them back as a school teacher.
Exactly. I will say this, too. I mean, that question, like, when can they come back? When is enough? It's always framed in terms of the women's inability to forgive, right? If only we could recognize that even good people can do bad things. If only we could recognize that people can grow and get better. And that just reduces us to a sticking point. That just leaves us, it denies us any, I mean, it's just such an oversimplification of everything. But I mean, look, I'm not out there deciding what Charlie can or cannot do professionally. Like private companies are deciding, right? People, you know, executives who live in a world full of multiple, like full of talented options, right? They're deciding, right? It's not as though, I mean, this, the question is so reductive about what to do with them. And, you know, like these men, yeah. And I can't say, you know, there's also to ask this question, it's just how to even begin to craft a response when each man, each story of abuse, I mean, the level of accountability and also the work that it takes, which, you know, is like also getting to someplace better is like it requires something of the abuser as well. It's not just like you can wait for the women who have spoken out. You know, it's not like it's a one-sided streak. They have to do something as well. In fact, it demands more of the abuser than it does of them. But anyway, not to just go off too long on this, but I think that question has been asked for 7 years now. And what my book tries to make clear is we know enough now about how these men ascend to power, how they maintain power. Maybe we're better off asking what to do with ourselves, right? And maybe we could actually get someplace.
Great point. The book is amazing. It is Complicit: How Our Culture Enables Misbehaving Men. It is published by Gallery Books. Rhea Bravo, I thank you so much for spending time with us and being so open and so really thoughtful on all of this. It's I appreciate the conversation very much.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for having it.
Be well.
And inviting me.
Again, the name of the book is Complicit. It is published by Gallery Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.